Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Jill Ajizi. Welcome to Family Matters. And as always, my lovely co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence, is here. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, Jill. How are you?
I'm terrific, although I have a ruptured plantar plate, and I'm not happy about that, and I'm looking at a surgery on my foot, and you know how I'm a nervous Nelly and can't sit still, and that's going to be extremely difficult for me.
Wow. Well, listen, you always know that if you need any help in any way, don't call me.
I know. You're exactly right, because you and I would drive each other insane, and then we would have to go to our guests for counseling.
Or write another book while you're healing. I hope you do that.
Plantar plate surgery and nervousness. Well,
it's awful.
Well, one exciting thing coming up for us, and that is the AFCC convention in Chicago. We're presenting there, and there's many other terrific people coming to Chicago for that conference. And so if you're in the Chicagoland area or any of the states nearby, we invite you to contact AFCC.com and take a look at them. It's the Association of Family and Conciliatory Courts, and there is going to be mental health professionals, legal professionals, all of the people who really are involved in the arena of parental alienation. Glenn, I don't know if you're coming. Dr. Glenn Caddy is on with us tonight. Are you going to be in Chicago, Glenn?
I could be persuaded. I haven't planned on it, but that's only because I'm busy. But maybe we can facilitate something there.
Yeah. We'll talk about that. But Michelle and I are excited. Michelle's presenting in more than one session. Michelle, what are your topics besides
High conflict divorce parenting skills, and then you and I are talking about parental alienation skills.
Good. And you're presenting with who on the other session?
I'm presenting with Don Gordon, who is a PhD who's written all kinds of online programs for parenting programs, including high conflict.
Well, we've got the NATO conference in Chicago this coming weekend, which looks like it's going to be a really big goat rope to me, because no roads are open and you pretty much have to cage yourself in your house all weekend. And then the AFCC convention, which will be considerably better.
What is a goat rope?
A goat rope means it's a fiasco. That's a Central Illinois term.
I think it is.
A Illinois term for a fiasco.
I'm using it in a sentence before the sun sets.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to fit it right into the show. So.
And then can I get an amen is your other favorite thing to say, I know. So
yes.
The other thing I want to talk about briefly is the incredibly successful Parental Alienation Awareness Day that occurred on April 25th. We had such an outpouring of support for that day in Illinois and in Pennsylvania. We had the month of parental alienation awareness proclaimed, which was so exciting, first time ever. Illinois, I'm so proud of you and our legislators recognizing the fact that parental alienation exists. They're looking at it. They understand it. Some of them have had personal experience with it. So that's exciting that people are really taking notice. We had numerous Bubbles of Love events, which is our campaign to create awareness, blowing bubbles at noon in their respective time zones all over the world. And so it was an exciting day that just culminated in news reports and newspaper articles, and it was very, very exciting. Were you blowing bubbles that day, Michelle?
Yes.
From the bench?
It was gum, but it was my version.
That's okay. It was a bubble. Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter.
Well, tonight, back by popular demand, we have, as I said earlier, Dr. Glenn Caddy from Fort Lauderdale, my second home. And we were just talking about he is on the 20th floor looking out at the ocean right now, Michelle.
I know. And I expect him to be a really good guest because of that.
Yes, he better be. But,
well, at least I'll be in a good mood.
You better be. Because if you're not, who's going to be?
Who is going to be? he really needs no introduction, but I'll just give you a short idea about what Glenn is and does. And he is in the state-of-the-art assessment, consultation, and treatment services to adolescents and adults addressing issues in everyday life, such as marital, child, parent, workplace problems, to matters across a broad range of mental health, sexual health, and behavioral medicine concerns. We like Glenn because Glenn is one of the very small handful of experts that exist in the parental alienation arena. And for some reason, Florida has a lot of experts there in Glenn and Mike Bone and Richard Sauber. And so there's a lot of people there that are helpful. But worldwide, Glenn is sought after. He's from Australia. You'll hear his lovely voice. You could listen to it for hours because that is just melodic. Glenn, we're happy to have you here tonight, and we're going to cover a topic that we've never done before. I mean, we've done parental alienation six ways from Sunday, but we've really talked about – there's another one for you, Michelle.
Another thing I was going to say.
But that would be Mount Vernon, Illinois. But we've never really talked about how it directly affects grandparents and the child relationship. So welcome, Glenn.
Thank you, and I'll try not to throw in too many Australianisms.
Let's just all be nothing but platitudes the rest of the show.
Exactly.
Well, Glenn, let's start just by talking about grandparents. Do they contribute significantly to the upbringing and wellness of a child when they're working through their adolescence and childhood and evolving into the person that we hope that they're going to be?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. You know, Hillary Clinton, you know, talked about, you know, it takes a village, and there's no question that it does. And grandparents are often, you know, especially these days with parents working or a single mother or something, or a single father trying to raise children, grandparents become incredibly important in the support process. I mean, I think there are times when some children have almost better relationships with one particular grandparent than sometimes they do with their own parents, depending on their stage of development and the various conflicts that are going on in their lives. So without question, these people are absolutely central.
Are they central in in the sense of brain development as well, the extended family?
Absolutely. I mean, is
there any necessity for them in terms of full development? You know how there's a need for a mother and there's a need for a father in terms of developmentally. Do grandparents play into that at all?
They do, because they also become critical elements in the child's identification of family. Critical elements in a family don't simply constitute the two parents. They give a sense of the longevity, the cultural longevity within the family. They give a sense of the relationship between the parents and the parents' parents. Just as, you know, cousins and other close relatives and uncles and aunts give a sense of the scope and nature of the family system. These children learn about groups, small groups, in the earlier stages of their development by interacting with others who bring intimacy and closeness to them. And those grandparents are often right there in the middle of things. Sometimes, you know, in this complex world we live in, where grandparents may not always live close by, almost inevitably the child or children suffer some compromise on the best opportunities. And, of course, that's providing that the grandparents are devoted and loving and not dysfunctional.
Right.
But making the assumption that we're talking about, you know, a healthy family or, you know, a family that where there is close connection and living together, then these people are very important.
Today, Glenn, I had an interesting conversation. I picked up a young man who was helping me move some things, and he had started talking to me about coming back from California to Illinois to see his grandfather, who was very sick. And I said, well, where are you staying? And he said, well, I'm not staying with my mom. And I said, why? And he said, well, when my parents got divorced, my mom tried to tell me that my dad didn't send the child support checks. And, you know, I saw through that because I asked my dad when I was 8 years old, what's going on with the support checks? And he said, son, I'm sending the support checks and here are copies of them. Now, I said, when you were 8 years old? He said, yeah. He said, I just didn't want to put up with it. And this kid, the more he told me, the more wise that I saw he was. And he's now lives in California and is married and doing very well. But I said, how did you decide that you weren't going to put up with this essentially what was becoming parental alienation? He said, I just wasn't going to put up with it. I told my mom if she was going to do that, I was going to go and live with my dad. And eventually that's what happened. And I said, did you maintain a relationship with your grandparents, your mother's grandparents, or your mother's parents? And he said, absolutely. And then we started talking about my situation, and he said, why don't your kids talk to your mom and dad? And I said, that's a full-blown parental alienation situation where if the tentacles reach to every member of the family. And I think people don't understand sometimes when they look at you and talk to you and see you. And I remember Barbara Walters asking me, why don't your kids talk to your parents? What did they do?
Yes.
So
yeah.
How do you explain the fact that an entire side of a family how does the alienator work through that? How do they get the child to turn against an entire side of a family?
Well, I think firstly we need to really understand that alienation, the process of the alienator is really quite pathological. They ultimately have to believe. Let's assume that the other parent is really a loving parent, maybe not a perfect parent, but a loving parent, and a loving person, who's quite capable of contributing substantially to the well-being of the child at multiple levels. To set about to alienate a good person from good children in order to try and ensure your greater power or total power over the children, you have to be prepared to be outrageous. Either that, or you have to be truly disturbed and buy into a belief system created by your own rage or anger. And when you do that, you're really becoming pathological at the level of a delusion. You are now buying into your own belief system and building a delusion. And by definition, a delusion is something that is not real but is believed and is used as if conviction to the condition. And so if what you believe you have to do in your pathology is to do everything you can to destroy the bond between say your husband or your wife, and the other parent, then you are also almost inevitably going to have to tackle the task of destroying the relationship between that parent, that alienated parent, and their parents. Because if you can't do that, the grandparents will constitute a bond back to the alienated parent that will dissolve the ability of the alienator to succeed. So it requires the ultimate conspiracy of the alienator and her parents. And the alienator will do the same sort of job often on their parent, on the parents, on his parents or her parents, as that alienator will do with respect to the children, in the sense that they will present an image of this other party that is particularly negative and they will, one way or another, engender their relationship, the love that their parents have for them, to turn those parents also against this parent. And in the process, there is the real risk, if they succeed, then his parents, you know, the alien, I don't believe that there's a his or a hers, I mean, whoever the alienator
right.
is, but that person's parents, you know, will become part of the problem.
So when you talk, when we all we all know on this program that parental alienation is generational in nature. So my question is, do you think that the pathology is shared or transferred down from grandparent to child on some level?
I don't think it's transferred in any biological sense the way some other you know, family dynamics and family attributes or characteristics are. But I do think that the preparedness to buy into your son or daughter's orientation to alienate is one in which, unfortunately, the alienator's parents are vulnerable to simply accept the premise of the alienation because they see it as in their interests to support their child rather than reject the child's premise. And they also sometimes fear, it's unconscious often, but if they don't agree, then the child or the children will also be alienated against them.
Yeah, they'll turn the children against them and they'll lose their grandchildren.
And so that's not something that most grandparents, you know, have the stomach to risk. And so either they will really buy into the alienator's agenda, or if they don't do that, they will often be rather silent with respect to the issues, so that when the children are around them, they don't actively support the alienation. But they fail to help the children reject the alienation.
But Glenn, do they understand? So many grandparents wouldn't even understand how to guide the child to reject the alienation because they don't understand it. So what
That's right.
would they say to a child? Because I know my parents struggled with this. My father, a former congressman, my mom, a homemaker, great parents. I had the best childhood ever, best parents ever. And they both struggled with what to say, how to deal with it. Maybe just being quiet's better, because if you bring it up, then you run the risk of losing them. But eventually they did. So how do you tell them to respond to these children without walking on eggshells and acting like you're, you know, just a being in the room?
I think that if you show the child a great deal of affection and you provide them with an environment in which, you know, Let's say it's your son who's doing the alienation, just for the purpose of the exercise. And what you do, therefore, is love the children, but do not allow yourself to be drawn into the agenda of your child, which is a very difficult thing to do. Then just by not being drawn in and being open to allow the children to speak to you about their mother, in this instance, and to do so in positive terms, and then endorse the mother in the eyes of the child without getting into the middle of, you know, a significant conflict with your son. The prospects of your son's success in his bid to alienate. The problem is that it's unfortunately a rare grandparent who will do that. it's a lot easier to buy into the premise that your child is absolutely correct, that this other person is an unacceptable person at multiple levels, shouldn't have ever had the children, shouldn't have a part of their rearing simply because they are so unacceptable. It's often easier to buy into that, and in which case then you become an extension of the alienation because now the children get further validation from the grandparents about the inappropriateness of the other parent.
Jill, was there ever a time when your parents asked you, well, is there anything you did wrong?
No, because they were with me every step of the way. I mean, 21 years. They saw it. They knew it. My dad has a degree in psychology. He understood, I think, what was going on in the marriage dynamic between my ex-husband and I. Certainly there was a lot of issues, psychological issues with my ex-husband that he had not dealt with from his childhood. So he understood that. But this whole thing was something new and different to him, nothing that he learned about in school. And I think, you know, they said they protected me and tried to help me through it because they knew that that was something, divorce was not something that I wanted to do, and tried to walk me through this and were there for the children every step of the way. My two older children were not my biological children, although I raised them from 2 years and 9 months, and they accepted them as their own grandchildren. And they were troopers, and they did what they could, but it just wasn't enough. And I think today, I mean, although I'm heartbroken, although I'm sad, although I think about my kids every minute of every day, I think for me the real sadness now is that my parents think about it every day and wonder what is going on with my kids.
Dr. Katie, do you see a lot of situations where the grandparents can't understand it and actually believe that their child must have done something to deserve it?
I think that sometimes happens, but more often than not, there is general support of the child by the grandparents. What I see in many grandparents is abject confusion and difficulty coming to grips with, even vaguely comprehending, you know, how all of this really came about, you know, in the sense that they are often absolutely lost to understand it. Even if they try and be independent a little bit of their own child's point of view, trying to grasp the enormity of how anybody can do this is often quite difficult for grandparents. I think that grandparents can be very wise and very intelligent, but, you know, because they come from yet one more generation back, they may not be right in the middle of thick of it in terms of what's going on with the law, what's going on with the relationship with, you know, with their children and the other parent. Often, while their child can't believe it's happening or can't imagine what's gone wrong, the grandparents at you know, one generation back and maybe not as intimately connected with all of the details, you know, are even more at a loss to comprehend what has happened and how it's happened and what in the heaven's name they can do.
How do you think, Glenn, we could affect change in legislation in states that really recognize no grandparents' rights at all? I was looking at a study from Oxford University that clearly said in the UK, you know, really this study was delivered to Parliament for to try to influence change in the grandparent laws. And the study showed that at times of family breakdown and separation, many grandparents played an important role in bringing stability to their grandchildren, and that grandparents were also found to be important in times of family adversity and appeared to help the whole family buffer the difficulties. These researchers concluded that given the grandparents' role is almost invisible in family policy in the UK, the government needed to rethink the policy implications of this largely positive role and provide more support for the important intergenerational relationships. So we need really to look at that in the United States and say these people are making a positive impact on children, and when there's a divorce, it's so important that that intergenerational bond is maintained.
Well, before you answer that, I had a case, and I've had many. In one particular case, the grandparents were practically the primary caretakers. And when mom and dad went to court in a custody fight, and I believe mom got awarded custody, paternal grandparents, by law, have absolutely no rights. It went all the way up to the Supreme Court in Illinois, and grandparents do have no rights.
No.
So they lost all the – it was really you want to talk about best interest of the children's standard. They had what was called no standing.
Yes, yes.
Is it the same in Florida? Because Florida has a heavy lobbying for grandparents.
Florida does, because there are so many grandparents who live in here in Florida, for example. I mean, you know, a lot of grandparents decide to move to Florida for the weather, etc. And yes, there is, but in terms of the law, at the present time in Florida, grandparents don't have standing.
Wow, so probably nowhere then, I'm thinking.
Well, you know, I don't know of any state in which grandparents have specific standing. I mean, you can go to court and get the court to agree, and then write an order to that effect in an individual case, but the legislature hasn't done, in my view, an even remotely rational job. Children may be, so long as there isn't the presumptive right of other family members to relate to a child is nothing but the possession of a parent. And that concept, in essence, I think, is despicable. And conceptually, it's vanished from all of the psychological literature and the health literature and things like that, in terms of the emotional development issues. But the law is a slow moving instrument.
Well, you can imagine how difficult it is to rule in a case where the grandparents get cauterized from the child's life, knowing that when you make your ruling, it's going to inflict immediate trauma to the child, I mean, severe trauma, and, you know, with goodness knows how many consequences. Of course, the argument has always been against grandparents' rights that the state is not supposed to interfere with decisions of the parents. The decisions of the parents are paramount and supreme.
But then, Michelle, you look at a case like there's a woman named Shirley Stevens out of Florida who founded a grandparents' rights group, and you can find her on Facebook. But she has a statement in the chat room, and her situation is this. Her grandson was abandoned by his mother for the first 4 years, and she was the caretaker for this boy. They bonded. They were close. Of course, wonderful relationship. And then his mother took him back, moved in with a man that beat up this little boy. And in defending her grandson, her daughter then in turn alienated her to punish her. The daughter took the side of the man and turned against her mother and kept the little boy. And DCFS in Florida can't step in because it's a parent-child relationship, and this woman has no right.
Sure.
She's moved as close as she can to this little boy to try to maintain some sort of relationship. She has none, and she's beside herself. And why wouldn't she be?
It's a paradox when the general standard during a divorce proceeding relates to the concept of best interest of the child, but best interest of the child never extends outside the specific limits of the parents. And yet, in many, many families, the grandparents are critical. They often provide, for example, I've been involved in cases where both of the parents had significant drug problems, and it was the grandparents on both sides who rendered the stability, while the two parents waged war with each other over a very extended period of time. And they were married.
In severe cases, et cetera. In severe cases, there are circumstances where they can petition for legal guardianship.
Yes.
But not easy, but, it's kind of an option. The funny thing is, I know enough people who have difficult in-laws, children married to somebody that they don't exactly like, who have children, and all they know to do is make sure they just kiss their behind every day.
Right.
Because they're terrified. If something happens, they're going to be ousted.
And then on the alternative side, we've got the grandparents who help in promulgating the alienation and make it worse than it could ever be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen those testifying in court. They're like cookie cutters in their testimony.
Yep.
So as a result of all of this, I know that you've gotten involved on a proactive basis organizationally. So why don't you tell us something about what you got involved in and what's going on? We'd like to hear all about that. Is it a national group or is it just Florida?
Well, it's at the moment. Well, let me tell you about the organization. There's a woman whose name is Susan Randall, and she contacted me probably about a year ago and wanted to talk about alienation, wanted to know more about alienation. She was never a patient of mine or anything. She was a person out in the community, and so I didn't choose to ask too many personal questions. But it's pretty unusual when somebody who, hasn't been touched by a particular problem or all of a sudden decides to take up the problem. But she was interested in putting together a group of people who were grandparents who'd been alienated. And she'd come across enough people, in her travels that she decided that this was something that was really important to do. And she formed a not-for-profit corporation called Alienated Grandparents Anonymous. And she's located in Naples, Florida. Now, the significant thing about this organization is grassroots as it is, they put up a website and they started getting contacts from various places. And I did a consult for a lawyer in Australia on an alienation case about five or six months ago. And lo and behold, as a result of that, and just sort of talking about this issue, a person in Australia ended up contacting Susan and said, we would be interested in starting creating an alliance with you. And so what Alienated Grandparents Anonymous is presently doing is they're putting a package together for organizations, grassroots organizations around the country and around the world, and they're giving them sort of a package of How to Start Up a Local Chapter of Alienated Parents, Grandparents Anonymous. And they're actually starting to get some traction. Now, this is not something that's going to happen in, you know, 6 months or 12 months or 18 months to sort of build that network. But what they are impressed about is that that they're actually being identified. And they are, you know, in their own organization, they're attracting 50 to 75, maybe 80 grandparents, sometimes less, to meetings. And that's in and around Naples. And they've drawn me in to give a few presentations to grandparents about some of the special problems that grandparents are facing, or to answer questions. And they've done that. I think Dr. Michael Bone is coming down and to see them in a week or two. I think he may already been. They're doing a very good job. And again, it's the purpose is to simply sort of render a mutual support system for people who've been touched by parental alienation. And these grandparents are becoming very active, in part because most of them don't have to work. They have the time, they're retired, and so they're becoming quite vigorous in their planning, et cetera, of the growth of the organization.
What would that include, that being vigorous? Would that mean...
Encouraged to
pay legal fees for their children, to go into family counseling? I mean, what kind of actions actually be, and I understand the support, which is terrific, but what actually could they do?
Well, I think that what they're doing to begin with, what the organization is doing, is trying to foster an educational experience for the grandparents, mm-hmm. to give them the resources of knowledge. Because, I mean, many of these people are just, they're desperately upset by what's happening, but they don't have a strategy. They don't know what to do. They've often, what they've done is they've helped their daughter or son, often spend many thousands of dollars, sometimes many hundreds of thousands of dollars, only to find that things are still not going right, the grandparents themselves, are often not in a sense of despair, sometimes depression, sometimes disbelief, sometimes anger. They are, too, having, an emotional consequence for the roller coaster that they're perceiving. I had a woman call me from, I think it was Iowa, about 4 weeks ago. Her son was living in North Carolina, and I don't mean to criticize North Carolina law, but the traditionalism of mother gets. I think that the basic assumption in that court was, if there's a separation, if there's a divorce, just assume that the father is not going to get more than about 30% time with the child, 40% if he's incredibly lucky, but much, much more likely that 25% is the going standard. So this grandmother has been having the perception that the wife had been working on the child for, months before the separation took place to disconnect the child from the father. And, of course, in this particular instance, what facilitated it was that the father was a pilot. And so there were days when he had to be, he had to be away. And, of course, what then ultimately happened was that as the court was contemplating its ruling on the basis of visitation, the mother wanted to structure very specific days when the father could see the child. The problem is the father didn't have control over the days that he had to be away. And sometimes it would be 3 days at a time because he was flying internationally. The court found it extremely difficult to be able to set rules dealing with visitation when the father couldn't tell the court, I can be here on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, or I can be here Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And of course, the mother, who did have an agenda to be rigid, unbending, and to limit the father whenever possible, had substantial advantages in that courtroom. And so the grandmother is calling me, saying my son is on a trip, and I found out about you. Can you help us? So anyway, that gives you an illustration of just one case that's come up recently where, a grandparent just is totally lost, not knowing what to do, and feeling like they have to try and help their son and try and do what they can to have as much time with their grandchild as they can.
I think would be helpful from my point of view is grandparents get skills for communication. What to
yes.
say to mm-hmm. the going to be alienating parent in the early stages. So that they
yep.
would know what to say at the time of the divorce. At the time, sometimes they just never call again. If they could learn skills for dialoguing,
well,
even if
problem,
it doesn't work,
yeah.
to
the
keep
they,
in the mix, to not to say, listen, I'm still there for you. I still want to babysit for the children. You're a terrific mother. I want to help you. I mean, there's all kinds of things that they could do, certainly at the early stages.
Absolutely.
And I think they need, like, a little handbook about say this when you first learn of the divorce. Tell your child you're going to call the wife and you're going to say this. Do this, do that, don't do this, don't do that. I mean, I think it needs to be really spelled out.
And
like,
but Michelle, I think you need to have two different versions of that because you've got the parents that are like my parents that have been married for 51 years and who never contemplated divorce, or maybe they didn't tell me, I don't know. But they probably did.
Only for 10 minutes, right. 10 minutes.
But you've got those people who stayed together regardless of what was going on within their marriage, because that's what we did when you were married in the 40s, 50s, 60s, even 70s in some cases. I didn't have anybody in my high school class that was divorced. There was no one. So I think you need a set of plans for those people, those parents, and then you need a set of plans for the parents who were divorced, who did have that happen, that experience, and that the mother got custody of the children, and there probably was some alienation, although we didn't know the name because Richard Gardner hadn't coined the phrase. So, Glenn, in those two different situations, how do you deal with that?
I think that it can be complex. But one of the greatest dilemma is that if we think about the greatest probability of alienation, it comes in high conflict divorces. You know, you don't see alienation in low conflict divorces. It just doesn't happen because there's not the dynamics that would support it. There aren't often the legal dynamics, and there certainly aren't the emotional dynamics. But in these high conflict divorces, one of the problems is that too often the grandparents for both parties end up siding with their child, and then a war mentality develops. And once that war mentality develops, it's not all that different from a real war. You want to annihilate the other person, you want to stop the other person from succeeding, you want to do everything you can, you want to throw resources at it, and you learn to despise the other side, who only a few years ago you claimed to love and was, you know, welcome to be at your home anytime. The bottom line is that when that happens, if you as grandparents allow yourself to be so aligned with your child that you that you become a participant in the war, which is very easy to do and very difficult not to do, then you can be absolutely sure that you are contributing to the power of the other side to
to wish to alienate you.
So would you say in some cases where I know, I mean, I talk to parents all the time who are being funded by their parents. Would you say don't fund them financially if they're going to be in the war? Don't fund the war.
Well, I think that I think if you don't fund the war, you de-escalate the war, and you might result that the problem is that what you often get is you get one side with substantially more with substantially more money. What I would say is if neither grandparent would fund the war, then the war would be much smaller and much more likely to resolve much quicker, and we would reduce the potential power of the alienation place take full force and effect. But when you fund the war, you certainly to the of the rift becoming great enough. But if you choose to fund the war because you love your child and you believe that child needs support, that doesn't mean you have to despise the mother of the children or the father of the children. Doing so, and even if you do, then keep it to yourself and don't share it with the other parent. Despise silently. Play, if you need to, play a game. Now, do I feel comfortable as a psychologist telling people that they shouldn't, commit themselves to straightforwardness and integrity in terms of their feelings with the other person? No, I don't feel comfortable with that at a moral plane, but pragmatically, anything that you can do to maintain the bridge between that mother and those children, or that father and those children, is wise politics, because it may be that it will make a critical difference ultimately in the success of any effort to alienate.
It's the same thing as what I believe, that you don't tell your children anything about the other parent, even if it's the truth, if it would harm them, certainly in young children. Is it morally right to omit or not tell the truth? No, it probably isn't. But by the same token, there's a higher good, and, you know, it's always the worst of two decisions.
That's right.
And that just really exists. I mean, I think that the grandparents need to understand that if they criticize that parent, if they overstep their boundaries in terms of trying to tell them how to parent, they're on bad soil in terms of future relationships. Whether it's light alienation, that may not apply to full-blown, because that's a whole other story, but
right.
We always like to deal with all the different shades of the rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
You know, it's funny.
You shouldn't do this with your child. Honestly, they may not have the authority. They may really pay for that.
Well, and the other consideration is, let's say that you have a family in which one of the married couple, one of the parents, you know, has really a very serious problem. Let's say it's a drug problem. You know, there's no question that compromises the quality of that parent's ability to serve the needs of the child if that drug problem is intrusive. And chances are that it is. But, you know, lots of people have drug problems and stay married, and either correct the drug problems or, you know, raise children who have to deal with the consequences of those problems. However, if, on the other hand, we say, you know, what we're going to do is, as grandparents, is we're going to do everything we can to demean that parent in the eyes of the children because of that drug problem. What we may well be doing is demeaning the sense that the child has of who that child is. Because although the child may not like the notion that mommy or daddy has a drug problem, they don't want other people demeaning their parents either. Because if your parent is no good, what does that say about you?
Right. Well, and I always go back to what Amy Baker said, and I love this statement. When to turn a child against a parent is to turn a child against himself. And
yes.
And losing, how damaging, Glenn, because we have about 10 minutes left. Tell us how damaging it is for a child to lose half of themselves, to lose their heritage, to lose what they know about their ancestors. I want to just interject this thought. I talked to the CEO of Ancestry.com, and I said, look, yep, buddy, you need to get on board with us, because if you don't, you're going to have a whole generation full of kids who don't know the other half of themselves, and they're not going to be going to your website signing up for your monthly thing. So, come on.
Yeah.
He
very pragmatic.
That. But, I mean, it's really true, because if we keep going the way we're going, we're going to have a bunch of kids who don't know where their grandparents came from, who don't know any of their ancestral history. So how do you deal with that, Glenn?
I think that, ultimately very badly, because it is taking away something that is crucial to the well-being of the child. What I will say is, you know, if you asked me initially what impact this has, well, you take a look at the emotional consequences for many children who I've come across who have been alienated, and I think both of you have read some articles that I've produced dealing with exactly that. The case studies that look at the impact of alienation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's true that not every child who's alienated finds his way or her way into, you know, a mental health facility or a psychologist or a psychiatrist, but a very substantial number of them go through life very compromised by their experience, and often very angry, and without really understanding what is wrong with them. I had a woman who was a faculty member at a university, local university. She was a director of a nursing program. She was 42 years of age, and she came to see me about a year and a half ago. And she said, I want to see you because I think I may have been alienated. I think I may have been alienated. And she said, I've had a lot of problems in my life. I can't seem to maintain relationships. I've been diagnosed with depression, and it comes and goes. And I spent 2 hours with that woman, and I took a detailed family history, and towards the end I spent about 20 minutes with her sort of responding to what she told me by giving her the implications of what she'd been through and the extent to which her own software, you know, her own thinking processes had been compromised, infected, if you like, by the virus of alienation. And I then tracked back for her and looked at where, how the anger that she wasn't able to identify had come out subsequently as depression, and how it kept on recurring for her. And at the end of those 2 hours, she said, thank you very much. I'm going to make an appointment to see you. And then she called me about 4 or 5 days later and said, Dr. Caddy, I've decided that I'm not going to come and see you because I got so much out of just understanding what you said. I try and work myself. And I said, that's absolutely fine. You can't do it. It's not working for you. Come back and see me. But the very notion of giving her a detailed analysis of how she got there, she said, now I think I can work out how to stop my own merry-go-round, my own emotional merry-go-round. And I said, if you can't, then come back and see me. This is one example of a person through the process of having been alienated, and she told me the story about how she lost her grandparents, et cetera, et cetera. And now they're both dead, and so it's a little bit late now to try and recapture any of the dynamics that she would have had.
Glenn, that's what I worry about all the time, is the death of a grandparent. I mean, and again, in my own personal situation, and God forbid, but I know it's, you know, it's imminent. So how do these adult children deal with the death of a grandparent after losing that relationship? How much more devastating is that for them when they can't say goodbye or anything at all to these grandparents?
Well, I think it's a case-by-case basis. If the tragedy is, if they've been alienated profoundly enough and that alienation sustains itself over many years, then they also hate their grandparents. But think about it. Think about despising their mother or their father and the paternal and maternal grandparents and all the uncles and aunts and cousins, et cetera, et cetera. What a hideous distortion of an otherwise valuable reality have they experienced. So the very nature of their life is off balance. And they've got to try and fill in the imbalance. And often they end up doing it with psychopathological ways, you know, disturbed mm-hmm. ways. It is a terrible burden. But if on the other hand, and see, one of the other things that, if we think about what's happening these days, children are not having children. You know, young adults at are now getting married later. They're having children later. They're not having children at 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22. They're having children as you know, some earlier generations have done. They're having children often into their late 30s. And so if there is to be an alienation and grandparents are involved, those children, you know, may never really get to see their grandparents when they're adults. So that's another dimension.
I just want to add a little legal piece, too, because people listen all around the world. The best grandparent statutes that exist, in some jurisdictions, do allow a grandparent to come to court and try and prove, the burden is on the grandparent to prove, that failure to grant visitation.
Glenn?
Yes.
Are you there? I don't know. Somehow we lost Michelle, so we will
I just heard her drop off.
Yeah, she dropped off. I don't know. Maybe Nietzsche, her dog, went crazy. There's all kinds of things that go on there. But I don't know what the culmination of that question was. But what we've talked about here tonight, I think, is so incredibly important. And grandparents are out there hurting. Parents are out there hurting, and it goes from all the way. A lot of people don't even know Anderson Cooper's mother, Gloria Vanderbilt,
sure.
alienated. You know, so there's all kinds of people from the top all the way down that are alienated from their children, parents and grandparents, aunts, uncles and cousins, and it doesn't stop. And we need to continue to create this awareness. And you're out there doing that, speaking, talking about what needs to be heard by parents, by grandparents, by legislators, other mental health professionals and legal professionals. And I just applaud you for the work that you do in Florida and internationally for this parental alienation dynamic.
Well, thank you very much, Jill. We have a mutual admiration society here, because I think that three of us work together and we all appreciate, you know, the various roles that each party fulfills in trying to address this at whatever level we can.
Well, you're right, and there's not enough of us to go around, and really, the more people that talk about it, the more we're heard, and I'm seeing that. You know, 9 years ago, when I started this, there were very few people making noise, and now it's everybody that I can get to, and all of the people that they can get to. It's like that game Operator. You tell somebody, and they'll tell somebody, and they'll tell somebody. And it's really happening now. And with Michelle doing what she's doing in Illinois, we're using this state as a guinea pig. She's back on, and we're talking about Michelle.
I am.
just creating awareness and educating, and you're doing that, and that's amazing. We've got about a minute left.
Did you hear what I said about Minnesota?
No, because you left.
No. Oh, okay.
So I don't know what happened to you.
Well, there's big news in Minnesota. And I'm not going to do it with the Minnesota accent. That's not correct for some reason.
Don't.
But they passed a 35% presumption of parenting time to each parent. So that just happened. And that's a very big deal.
Good for Minnesota. That's
and for
terrific.
All grandparents.
There's a lot of advanced things.
Check your websites, all grandparents, to see whether or not your statute in your state allows you the ability to go to court. You have the affirmative burden to prove that the child will be damaged if they don't have visitation with you. There are some states that will allow you to do that. Just go on Google and check the statute.
Yeah.
Grandparent visitation.
Well, thank you both for being here tonight, Michelle and Glenn. We appreciate you always, and we'll have you back again. Thank you, thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you so much. And don't forget, Dr. Katie does reunification therapy, and there's way too few of you.
Absolutely. And you can, Glenn, what's your number and your email address?
My email address is glennkaddy, glennkaddy, @gmail.com.
Okay.
And my phone number is 954-547-5100, 954-547-5100, and you can Google me.
Great. Well, if you want Glenn, he's there for you, and we appreciate you so much. And I just want to tell everybody that our next show on May 30th is going to be another exciting show. It'll be hard to beat this one. But Jody Blanco, who is the New York Times bestselling author of the book on bullying called Please Stop Laughing at Me, and her new book, Please Stop Laughing at Us, we're going to be excited to talk to her because bullying and parental alienation kind of go hand in hand, and we can really tie that in with our show very nicely. So we're looking forward to Jody Blanco. Everybody have a great weekend.
Everybody goodbye, and thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks.